And Linda Moulton Howe, she's an Emmy Award-winning writer, television producer, investigative reporter, author who goes directly to the men and women at the forefront of science and environmental challenges. She heads up her website called earthfiles.com, which I really suggest you go to on a regular basis because she has incredible stories there. And she's going to update us on some very unusual stories we've been following here on Coast to Coast AM. Back with us for 2 hours tonight. Hi, Linda. How are you?
Hi, George. How are you?
Good. I'm doing great. Good to have you with us.
Well, may everybody have a healthy and a peaceful Memorial Day in spite of all of the seeming chaos and earth mysteries that just keep proliferating from everywhere all over this planet.
They never seem to stop, Linda, including some of the ones you're working on right now.
Yeah, remember 7 months ago that I reported on Coast to Coast about a 1,300-pound healthy black Angus cow that was found dead on October 9th of 2006 in Valier, Montana, and I went up there to investigate. And the ranch owners had seen the cow alive and well at 5:30 just the night before, and that animal's jaw was stripped clean, the udder was removed in a smooth cut, and the rectal and vaginal tissue had been cored out, all without blood. And this is the case where Sheriff Tom Kuka found this crater about 2 feet from where the cow landed and assumed that the cow had been dropped from the air high enough to hit the ground and bounce. And in fact, when biophysicist W.C. Levengood studied the soil and the plants that we were able to get from that pasture, he found in tests that something had fallen, that there was definite hard physical evidence of compression from hard impact on that soil and in that soil in the crater, but not from any of the other soil around the cow, the crater, or in the rest of the pasture. Now, the Ponderay County, Montana investigators did not know that further south in northern New Mexico, a red Angus bull was also found dead and mutilated on October 1st, 2006, which was only 8 days before the cow was found in Valier. Well, that is a small ranching community of Conjilon. It's spelled C-A-N-J-I-L-O-N, but it is pronounced Conjilon, New Mexico. It is surrounded by really high mountain peaks, 10,000 feet plus. And down in the valley, there are perhaps 1,000 head of cattle, and they're on various small properties. One rancher, Albert Martinez, has raised cattle in Conjilon for 50 years, and he had heard about animal mutilations in Dulce, Chama, Mora, and other northern New Mexico regions before, but he had never seen it with his own eyes until October 1st. And he was so surprised by the strange excisions on his red Angus bull that he talked with neighbors and local authorities about it. And the Rio Grande Sun ended up doing a newspaper story about that bull mutilation, and it caught the attention of Gallup, New Mexico, animal mutilation researcher Robert Allen. Robert traveled to Conjilon on October 4th, just 3 days after Mr. Martinez found his bull. He met with Albert Martinez at the site. He looked for tracks. He looked for all kinds of signs of things on the ground, and he did a night watch from one of the mountains to see if any aerial craft would show up because people were always reporting weird lights. And Robert Allen was surprised by what he saw both on the animal and in the night sky.
We went to the site, and this was approximately 50 hours after the bull was mutilated.
Mm-hmm.
And I measured the distance from the bull itself out to about an 80-yard perimeter there and could not find any footprints, tire tracks, any sign of anything coming to the bull or leaving it. I was startled to find the precision that these cuts were made on the genitalia. Its anus was gored out. Its testicles and penis were removed. It had one eye missing. It had strange marks over its rib cage. It had these cut marks on its hooves and its legs, like something cut these nodules off.
And this is the dew claw.
The dew claw, yes.
And that very specific removal of the dew claw, in which there is a hole left And the dew claw is taken so neatly, has, in my mind, been one of those details that not many people know.
Yes, it also had the lips around its mouth down to the jawbone there, removed just in the surface where the teeth are. It wasn't cut all the way back to the ear. The front of its lips were removed, and one of its eyes was taken out, its right eye.
Could you discuss what Mr. Martinez told you about blood on the animal when he found it?
Well, he was puzzled because there was no blood on the ground. There was no blood trail off to the brush there. No blood was coming out of the animal. Also, he said there was an amazing smell to the animal. He said it smelled, how he described it, was like a dentist's office and a doctor's office put together.
Oh, so a medicinal smell.
A medicinal smell, yes. And he says it was quite pungent. You could smell it from a pretty good distance. Now, on the other side of the pasture there, we went to, and there was marks on the other side of the pasture on approximately 60 yards away from where the bull was found mutilated. You could tell an object landed there. There was indentations in the ground, and it was quite puzzling because the terrain, that was on a slope there. So this object came down on a slope and landed.
And what were the marks like?
Oh, they were round in circular pattern. This is October, so the ground was more soft than the hard freeze. So it probably was down a good, I'd say, 12 inches in the ground.
And how big?
I'd say a foot.
And did they have a pattern on the ground?
Triangular pattern. We saw one off to the distance there, to the north of it, and then went to the east and west, and it was a triangular marking there.
Three circles going down 12 inches into the soil on a slanted hillside.
Yes, and they were absolutely precise. There was no variance in them. So that object came down neatly, made that impression, and it took off neatly. I could not find any disturbance on the ground. I didn't see any of the burnt marks. There was no tracks at all going from this hillside to the bull.
And how far, in terms of feet, would you estimate it was from the body of the mutilated bull to where those three triangular impressions were in the hillside?
I would say approximately 80 yards. Went to the rancher. He's been there approximately 50 years himself. His family's from there. His children were born and raised there. And he's been a rancher all his life. His father was too. The area is predominantly Forest Service, the people that work there, and ranching. Over the years, they've seen bizarre light displays over that area. His daughter and her husband were walking through there probably about a year earlier to that, and they saw these amazing lights in the sky at night. From what he told me, the lights were circular in a pattern. They were yellow, blue, and red, the lights. And they came in at an amazing speed, and they stopped on dime. And they viewed it for a while, 25, 30 seconds. And the lights took off towards the north of it in an incredible speed, was gone in a matter of a second out of their view.
Do I understand that what they were seeing when these different colored lights came together, the lights formed a ring in the sky?
A ring in the sky, yes. They specifically saw the lights that were yellow, blue, and red under the belly of it, I assume.
But are we talking about one large object or multiple smaller objects?
One object coming in. And they saw this several times over the years in this area. I saw the incredible light there right after this mutilation in October, as I camped up in the mountains there for almost 2 weeks.
Yeah, describe what you saw with your own eyes.
Well, it was approximately about 8:30. The mutilation took place the 1st of October. I was there from the 1st of October to approximately the 12th or 13th. On the 4th of October, I'm sitting there hoping up on top of a mountain that oversees the valley there that another mutilation was going to take place. And approximately 8:30 that night, I viewed an object coming in at a speed that I could not calculate. It came in so fast. It came from the east over the mountains there, down into the valley, and over to a ridge across A.E. Calion there. And the object was a bluish-white streak. It came in accelerating at an amazing speed, and it was losing altitude at the same time. So it looked like it was coming, like it was shot down into the mountainside. It went right into the mountain. I went over to the area. I tried to find it. The terrain's too rugged. It was dark. and I couldn't pinpoint exactly where this object came in, but I just believe that these objects are coming in and out of this valley on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. And that was then the night of October 4th. The bull was found mutilated by the owner on October 1.
Yes.
Now, has anybody in law enforcement in that valley ever just said to you straightforwardly, we're dealing with creatures not from this planet?
Well, I talked to a police officer up there who was there for 34 years, and he investigated several mutilations over the years, and they've never been able to determine how the animal has been killed. No one's been able to find out any person involved in it. No one's ever been arrested. No one's ever been filmed. Some of the mutilations were 4 hours apart from seeing the actual animal to when the animal was found mutilated. It was just startling to these ranchers that they would go out there and view the animals, and then 4 hours later they'd find one mutilated, not knowing how it happened. No signs, no sign of struggle, no predator kills. None of these animals have any type of teeth marks on them.
Not predator.
No predator at all. So something obviously is landing.
Or they're taken someplace, and it's all done, and they're returned through this beam technology that I've had at least a dozen eyewitnesses who are ranchers describe to me, seeing animals rising in beams of light or lowered in beams of light or dropped from something in the sky that is glowing down through trees, making a ruckus, which is why ranchers have noticed in the first place.
Yes, and I also investigated one in Arroyo Hondo there where they found a bull that was killed under a trailer, which was amazing.
As if it were put there almost like, how would you do this? This is what we can do.
Exactly. It was just a blatant display of power and technology. And these people, when they saw that, were just absolutely stunned. I talked to a gentleman there in Chama who said that he saw, this is incredible, they were going up the pass from Chama there. That's at 7,800 feet, so you're going up to 10-4 on the pass. They were climbing up to the front pass there, Cumbres, and they saw an object come down from the sky. It was a solid object, and he saw several objects split from it and go in every direction and fly in zigzag circular patterns and then all come back and join itself again. And he came down to his car. He was with a friend, and they were sitting there. And the object came virtually almost on top of the hood of the car, shined an amazingly bright light into the car. The object stayed stationary there for a couple minutes as if they were viewing the vehicle. It shot straight up, and then it broke up in two other spheres and went in every direction, zigzagged around, and it returned itself to the original form, and it shot off to the sky at breakneck speed.
I've had several witnesses over the last 20-some years tell me that they have seen these beams of light come down into pastures or into forests. They've seen animals go up into the beams. They've seen animals come down in the beams. And they have heard animals drop literally down through trees, breaking branches. And then they find the mutilated animals on the ground in little craters where their bodies have dropped, just like Pend'Oreille County, Montana, a few months ago. And in what I think is one of the most important books that has come out in the last few years, it is The Day After Roswell by former U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso. And he described in great detail the U.S. government cover-up of a non-human craft and bodies in the back engineering of non-human technologies. And he wrote, quote, in the Pentagon from 1961 to 1963, I reviewed field reports from local and state police agencies about the discoveries of dead cattle whose carcasses looked as though they had been systematically mutilated. Local police reported that when veterinarians were called to the scene to examine the dead cattle left in fields, they often found evidence not just that the animal's blood had been drained, but that entire organs were removed with such surgical skill that it could not have been the work of predators or vandals removing the organs for some depraved ritual. Lieutenant Colonel Corso told me in his own words before he died in 1998 that he had looked at classified documents in the Pentagon during his work in Washington about unusual animal deaths around the planet in both hemispheres, and that these highly classified documents said the perpetrators were, and this was a quote, extraterrestrial biological entities, and the earliest date that he saw in a document was 1951, 1951, only 4 years after the alleged crashes in Roswell, New Mexico. And beginning in 2002, there has been another wave of animal mutilations in Argentina. Authorities estimate there have been more than 3,000 cases. And now, again, this April to May 2007, there have been cattle mutilation reports from Argentina and new chupacabra puncture attacks in Chile. And I'm going to have an update on that after the break.
Good work, Linda. It's just an amazing story. They just never stop,
no,
they?
They don't.
Oh, my. And you're going to also update us a little bit later on tonight about this incredible UFO story,
well,
whatever it may be.
I don't know. See, I've never followed it as a UFO. I think it's a black government project.
Well, until we identify it, it's a UFO.
Right. Right? That's true.
I'm not saying it's extraterrestrial. It is unidentified. And then later on in the second half of the second hour, we'll have conversations with you, Linda. We'll take phone calls for
you. Yeah, and I've got some updates on honeybees as well. But I'm telling you, this strange dragonfly thing, it is provoking some of the most interesting, I'll say, what seems to be emails from engineers and people with military background.
Okay, well, stick with us. Linda Moulton-Howe will be with us for the next hour and a half. And like I just said, the last half hour of next hour, we'll have conversations with Linda. But she still has two blockbuster reports for us to come on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Linda Moulton-Howe, who continues her investigation into the very strange and mysterious stories on this planet. Go ahead, Linda.
Thanks, George. Well, back in 2002, when this huge wave of animal mutilations began in Argentina and spilled over into Chile, authorities there were getting actual reports from veterinarians about high-heated excisions, very unusual organs removed from the side of the animals, and people were beginning to just talk everywhere in six provinces in Argentina that something that was not earthly was interacting with their animals, taking water from their water tanks, was associated with all of these beams of light people saw, lights in the sky, lights near the ground. It was really, really intense from 2002 to 2003. And in that period of time, Argentina's federal INTA agency, that's very similar to the USDA here in the United States, and it's referred to as SENASA, they had decided that everything was getting out of hand, and they were worried about panic. And so they held a press conference, and they even brought photographs with them. And they had an official press release that said that the answer to all of these animal mutilations, and this is a quote from the press release, were, quote, red-nosed mice whose nutritional habits had changed to eating cattle, unquote.
Yes, and eating them at precision ways.
Well, even the veterinarians there laughed at the government's explanation as preposterous. And the veterinarians knew that they had seen excisions on animals that showed signs of high heat. I talked through a translator out of Buenos Aires with a veterinarian who was talking about that he was looking at cautery, exactly like I had investigated with John Altshuler in Denver and Colorado and other places, the same exact evidence. Well, now Scott is going to explain to us that even though the Argentina government tried to get the farmers to stop reporting these mutilations and accept the mouse explanation, farmers, veterinarians, and others kept going to the media about new unusual animal deaths.
There are a number of print sources and electronic sources that have appeared in Argentina that have not been afraid to convey information on mutilations, even after the government accused them of fear-mongering after the 2002 wave of cattle mutilations.
When the government trotted out the red-snouted mouse is the explanation?
That's correct. And they figured, look, we've already given you the answer to this mystery. If you insist on suggesting that there's something beyond this, you're creating a panic and you could be liable.
And so people have been afraid to report mutilations, even with the fact that more than 3,000 cases have been reported over the last 5 years.
Absolutely. Many of these farmers, we're talking about very, very small landowners here. Sometimes you're talking about huge ranches, but the concept of insurance, insuring your herd, not an issue. Most of these people lose the animals, they've lost livelihood. And they figure, look, let's not get ourselves involved in government trouble to add to our misery. But in this case, the one from Novo Diario Web, 5 head of cattle turned up mutilated, causing concern among the residents of this location, which is 50 kilometers distant from the city of Sumampa. The victims in this case involved 4 heifers and 1 calf, and as has occurred in many other cases, they were missing tongues, udders, eyes, and tails. They were found some 300 meters from the home of farmer Julio Farias, who explained, and I quote, "It has been a week since we found the animals, and they haven't shown any signs of decomposition. Birds of prey are only now starting to approach the location," end quote. Part of the article mentions that the Dulce River, which runs through that area, has been at its flood stage, and of course, as the floodwaters receded, has left a lot of mud and loam in its wake. And you should be able to see any kind of prints of anyone trying to approach the animals in question. This has not been the case.
So we have 5 animals, and that there's no blood on the bodies, and that there's no signs of tracks, even in wet soil.
That is correct. Every 2 years, we do seem to get some kind of resurgence of these cases. I think it was back in 2003 or 4, we had those cases in Chile, not in Argentina, involving the winged simian creatures that attacked the farmer near the town of Parral. Perhaps the most impressive of these cases involving this particular mutilating creature came from the city of Concepcion in Chile, where Professor Liliana Romero heard noises coming from the courtyard of her apartment building at 1:30 in the morning. When she went to look, she sees, and I quote here, "an immense man, 2 meters tall, with shoulder blades split as though it had wings." The following day, she found a dead dog with puncture marks in its neck in the courtyard. So this entity was clearly exsanguinating something. Chupacabra's cases involving sightings of strange creatures always seem to begin in April. The traditional chupacabras with the spines down the back.
Mm-hmm. The one that stands and walks and can go down to 4 legs in spring, which is different from the black bat-like whatever it is.
Absolutely correct.
Why do you think that there's been a focus in Argentina and Chile?
That is a very good question, and I guess it would probably have to do with the fact that Argentina and Chile have been focuses for strange phenomena going back at least to the 50s. Let's say that these are extraterrestrial force. There's lots of UFO cases, suggestions that there are UFO bases off the Argentine coast and in the Andes.
There are basically 6 provinces where there's been the focus of the animal mutilations in Argentina. And are those 6 provinces where all of the cattle are raised in Argentina?
Most things seem to be coming from La Pampa, also from Rio Negro, from Chubut. As you start going from the Buenos Aires area on down, the city of Santa Rosa and that entire area, let's say 50 to 75 miles around, is one of these very strange parts of the world that seems to attract any kind of weirdness to it. They have UFO cases. They have cases involving small private planes that can't find their way back to the local airport because they report the terrain beneath them has changed completely. You have your chupacabras cases, cattle mutilations, and cases involving witchcraft, cases involving ritual magic. I mean, you have so much stuff in that one particular area.
Could there be a relationship between the electromagnetic fields of this planet that some can collapse at points, and if there are collapses in certain geographic areas because of something having to do with the geography, maybe it allows this, what should we say, parallel time, parallel universe, something to be able to come into where magnetic fields are not stable?
If you look at the map of mutilations back in 02, a lot of the cases seem to be occurring in almost a straight line. And perhaps they were following some kind of fault where there was a weakening of some kind of energy or some kind of, I guess, a lee line of some sort. It was very interesting. They all seemed to be lined up.
Right, and that lining up of dead animals has occurred in the United States as well. I've documented a case in Hope, Arkansas back in 1989 in which five pregnant cows were all lined up and mutilated. When you think about chupacabras in Chile, what is the strangest case that you remember translating?
In the month of May 2003, six witnesses, five boys and their uncle, were treated to the amazing sight of very, very small, imp-like creatures, more like elves. They were described as having dark gray skin, oval heads, long pointed ears. And these little creatures were involved in attacking a flock of lambs on the property. One of the creatures punched a lamb until it fell to the ground. This is something that had not been seen previously in any of these incidents involving strange creatures and farm animals. What I found stranger still of this report is the fact that the onlookers were reportedly in a stupor, unable to react, unable to do anything about it, just helpless onlookers as their animals were being attacked by these strange creatures.
So not only out of Chile do we have eyewitnesses to these strange, small, gray, pointed ear creatures punching a lamb that falls to the ground, sort of like a chupacabras attack.
Punching.
But there were, and Scott was telling me this is one of another very interesting case. This is also in Chile. And in one instance, there were school children, and they were on their way home. And they reported seeing an animal jump off of a rooftop that was near them, and it came down in their path, blocked them, and as if it were confronting them. But the children told all of their parents and the teachers that when this thing jumped down, it was hovering off of the ground, and it seemed to be hovering a number of centimeters off of the ground. And these are the kinds of eyewitness cases that are, I mean, George, we're talking probably hundreds and hundreds of where people have seen creatures floating, odd creatures, the beams of light. There was even a case back in the 2002-2003 period that was back in Argentina, and there were some people at a lake, and they saw somebody, which they thought it was a person, rising in a beam of light into a disk in the sky. And so this part of the world, if you said, is there one place on the planet where there have been maybe the most complex richness of high strangeness associated with unusual animal lights, mysterious lights, and unusual animal deaths, it would be Chile and Argentina. And we're getting cases again in the spring of 2007. And I want everybody to know that at my news website, www.earthfiles.com, I have all of the images and the text from all of these reports tonight having to do with the unusual animal deaths, Chile, Argentina, the strange drone or whatever it is, and a whole series of reports also on the disappearing honeybees. So use Earth Files as a news supplement having to do with facts about some of these Earth mysteries.
Linda, this one is bizarre. What do you think's going on there?
In the which one?
Well, the punching animal.
Oh, the chupacabras. I spent two full weeks in January of 1996 in Puerto Rico investigating at what would be kind of the midway of this big, big chupacabras phenomenon that seemed to emerge full-blown in Puerto Rico first. And while we were over there, I was able to talk with translators to people Madeline Todelin, who had one of these creatures walk right past their window. And she and her mom took me into their house, had me come to the window, showed me how they were taking a cloth, and they were cleaning the window. And right outside the window was the sidewalk. There was no grass, just sidewalk. And the mother and Madeline, through the translator, were showing me that no more than 3 feet from them, separated by glass, suddenly, coming slowly, not fast, was some kind of a creature they had never seen before in their life, standing approximately from the bottom of its feet to the top of its head, about 4.5 to 5 feet tall. And that they couldn't understand what whether it was drugged, sleepy, I think is the way they said it, because it was holding its hands or paws up in front of it, and there were only 3 fingers on each paw or hand. And there were only 3 toes that they could see very clearly on the sidewalk. And it had sparse hair, but there were spots. There was coloration, mottled coloration. The eyes, they compared in Spanish to English as looking like a gray jello, solid. They could see no white, they could see no black, just solid gray jello that was sort of slanted and long. And that all of a sudden, because they were so startled, and I think that the mother yelled, the creature went down now on what it was standing up, went down on all fours and sprang. And when it sprang, as so many people said when they saw this animal, that's why they thought it was like a kangaroo, it sprang 6-8 feet in one spring, and it only took 3 or 4 bounds, and it went across the street, over a car and over a fence that I was there myself. The fence was at least a foot higher than I was, and this thing just sprung over it. And those are two of the best eyewitnesses I talked to because of this extraordinary closeness that they had being on the inside of the house with the glass window and looking at this. Well, now, you would say, okay, we have to find out what that is. But I had as many interviews with people who did not see that particular, if you want to call it, spotted kangaroo with 3 fingers, 3 toes, and gray jello eyes. There were more, well, I'll say maybe 50-50, as many people who said that they saw what they thought was a black bat. And that's what a lot of the cases are in Chile, that it is something that can fly, that has wings. And in one particular case, I went to the house where a man showed me his dog. The dog still had 2 puncture holes in the right side of its neck, no blood. And the man saw this black-winged thing.
How big was it?
He said no more than about 4 feet, like a 4-foot wingspan.
That's a pretty big bat.
Yeah, but that it came down in front of him, on the back of his dog yelped, and then this thing took off, and when he ran over to his dog was actually chained. The dog couldn't run. There were the holes, and George, he said, there was no blood. They're just these holes, and those holes were still there when I went to his house and did an interview. Well, in Chile, they talk about the winged men. But they didn't have winged men in Puerto Rico, but they talk about things with wings in Chile that are attacking the animals. And so it's a very still confusing story about exactly what are the perpetrators. And I would say that there's more than one type, that there seems to be at least 2. And then the bigger question, are they something that was planted here that didn't evolve on this earth, which is what some people think, or is it some genetic aberration gone wild? And I don't know the answer.
Or could it be a creature that we just never identified on this planet?
Well, I'll tell you, probably the most definitive link to the so-called UFO non-human side were children in northern Mexico. And this was also a case in 1996, just before all the Chupacabra wave ended. And the children reported and drew on pieces of paper that they saw this silver disc come down in the field, and what walked out of it is what Madeline drew as a chupacabras in Puerto Rico. But I'm talking to you now south of the Texas border. And that what walked out of the disc, the children said, proceeded to attack the family dog, which died from puncture marks.
Linda, this one's a mind-boggler, too.
Well, I'm telling you, the next one is fascinating, even though I don't have answers on it either, but it is definitely fascinating, this drone or whatever it is.
Next hour, what do you have in store?
That's what we're going to talk about. What I have been learning, some recent data, and an eyewitness who has gone on the record, if not with her whole name, at least with part of her name, and it's extremely important to realize that a person who worked in the California state government for 25 years with no axe to grind and nothing to gain, wanted people to know that she saw this dragonfly, whatever it is, over Sequoia Park in California in May 2005, 2 years ago. And we're going to hear her own words after the break.
That's next. Just what the heck has been flying around the home of Chad? You know, we've been following this story now for 3 to 4 weeks. It is one weird story. Linda Moulton Howe is following up with that and the honeybees, wherever they may be, on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, I can't remember a story that has created so much interest and frustration and discussion than these photos that Chad sent everybody. They're absolutely incredible. Now we're going to have to reconnect with Linda because they have taken her away somewhere. So we'll get that. Anyway, it is true. This story, it happened about 3.5 weeks ago. Lex got several photographs from an individual named Chad, and he just sent us the most unbelievable UFO photos you've ever seen. Now, Linda's got some pictures of it on earthfiles.com. And, you know, go take a look at it at her website. But we've also got pictures of it on our own website, back in the files. So just make sure that you pick those up and take a look at that. And we'll try to reconnect with Linda in just a moment and take this right now. There you go. Linda, you there?
Yeah, that was so weird. It just went dead, deader than a doornail. Maybe somebody doesn't want me to say this.
Well, maybe they don't, but go ahead. I already did the introduction and the story, but not, of course, as well as you. So
well,
take it away.
All right. Well, you know, this has been an intense week where there's been a lot of, we'll say, explanations or efforts to explain away the Lake Tahoe, Capitola, and Central California Chad images as Photoshop and or what are called viral promotional films.
Right.
But I had the good fortune to interview a California resident. As I said earlier, she worked for the state government in the Department of Developmental Services in mental health for 25 years and before recently retiring in 2006. And she was born in Ventura County, California. She earned her psychiatric technician degree from Ventura Community College in 1978. I do have her full address and contact information and academic background, but she has applied to work in another state agency, so she has asked to simply be identified as Shirley from the Central Valley of California. She does not want the chaos surrounding the images to affect her new employment, but she does want the public to know that the Chad photos match a dragonfly-like aerial object that she saw 2 years ago. It was May 2005. She went on a weekend trip with her father to visit Sequoia National Park north of Bakersfield. Shirley and her father were near the center of the large Sequoia Park and Monument where they had planned to camp. But Shirley began feeling nauseous with a very bad headache and decided that she needed to go back home and rest. It was late afternoon, about 3 to 5 p.m., when she realized that she was lost and did not know what road to take out of the park. She had stopped at a Sequoia Park Ranger Station to ask a uniformed ranger for directions when she was so shocked to see what looked like a big dragonfly moving in the sky. And when Shirley saw the Chad photos at earthfiles.com and the Coast to Coast AM website, she said that is the object that she had seen. And here she describes what happened in her own words.
It was like around May of 2005, and we'd gotten lost as to which road to take out of the Sequoias to get back on the right road heading home. I told Dad, I go, pull over at the station. I'm going to talk to this park ranger and see if he can help us. Came over talking to this ranger, and while we were talking, this weird thing flew overhead. Never seen anything like it in my whole life. And I asked the park ranger, I go, what is that? And he just, you know, very casually just went, oh, he goes, yeah, you know, I'm told that it's some kind of a communications device. It's supposed to help the Park Service to monitor any possible problems, you know, fires and such. And that was pretty much his total explanation of what it was.
Can you give as many details as possible?
What I saw, the things that struck me right off the bat, the first was that it had a shape like nothing I've ever seen. The body of the thing looked to be like a circle, like a metal circle, but the things that body shape-wise that made it look so weird was the shape itself just, for lack of a better description, reminded me of a dragonfly. It had an extended, I'll call it an arm, for lack of a better word, a thin extension at the back, a circular body. It had like three or four shorter extensions. They were like between the side of the thing and the front of the thing. And it had these weird, like, wires that were coming out of the top of the thing, but you could tell that they were bent. They weren't straight. Mm-hmm. They were, like, curving. And, of course, I'd never seen anything shaped like that before that was flying around or otherwise. The second thing about it was just the way it moved. I mean, at first I thought, well, it reminds me of a helicopter, but it had a much smoother, quicker movement to it than what I've seen in any helicopter. And when I spotted the thing again later, we stopped again because we were still lost even after talking to the park ranger, and we pulled over and talked to one of the road crews that were out there. They were doing a lot of road repair. And that's when I saw the thing again, and it was off further in the distance by that time. But it did give me a better chance to actually look at the way the thing itself moved. And that's when I could see that, because at one point the thing backed up. And I just went, oh, look, it can go backwards just like a dang helicopter. And then it just kind of reversed itself and headed off in another direction, and I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, that's a nifty contraption. But it moves like, if you've ever sat there and watched a dragonfly over the water,
right?
Just sat there for the fun and watched them, because they're a hoot. Nothing else moves like them. That's how this thing moved. The dragonfly, the way that they're able just to kind of hover, and they've got real mobility, whatever direction they're going to point themselves at, they're going to go in no problem. The thing didn't move anything like, say, an airplane. It moved. It had a mobility closer to what I've seen in a helicopter. I mean, that's the only other thing I can think of that I can liken it to in that kind of mobility. But it had a smoother move to it. Mm-hmm. It had a quicker, smoother move than what I've seen with a helicopter.
Of the images that have been shared now on Earth Files and Coast to Coast and other websites from Lake Tahoe, from Chad in Central California, and from the Capitola, California images, which seems the very closest to what you saw in May of 2005?
Oh, no doubt about that. The Chad photos. The Chad photos are just about exactly what I saw that day in the park.
And the others are different in what way?
The Capitola photos, right away, I'm going, what is that thing that's projecting out from the side of the circular main body? You know, it looked like two round apertures. And I don't remember round apertures sticking out of the side of what I saw that day, and I didn't notice them in the pictures Chad took either. That was a difference. But the rest of the body, on the Capitola pictures looks pretty much like what I saw that day. But Chad's photos were right on.
Which part seemed to be going forward, the ring or the long tail?
I recall the longest extension moving like it was the tail of this craft. Again, much like when you see a dragonfly move. I mean, a dragonfly doesn't move with its tail to the front of it. You know, its tail follows it. I just thought, wow, isn't that interesting? We just keep coming up with better and better technology. I mean, that's honestly what I thought that day. I was like, I was impressed. I mean, I walked away, you know, kind of going, well, how nifty, you know, isn't our government amazing? We're just coming up with bigger and better things all the time, you know. I mean, that's honestly what I thought, and that's all I thought. I didn't walk away going, oh, my gosh, what are they trying to hide? You know, I just, right. I didn't. I mean, I just kind of walked away going, that's neat, you know.
And that's because the Sequoia Park Ranger dismissed it so casually, right?
Absolutely. I mean, if he'd looked startled or if he'd fumbled, like, you know, like, you know, people will do sometimes when you catch them off guard. But no, his demeanor and everything was nothing like that. He didn't act like it was anything to be concerned about. He didn't act like he was trying to hide anything. He didn't act like he was trying to come up with a good story, you know, nothing like that.
And you see all of the controversy coming about it must be photoshopped, that all of these images must be photoshopped. What is your comment to viewers and listeners?
Well, I can tell you right now that what I saw that day, that was not a Photoshop. I mean, I saw that in the real world.
And since interviewing her, I've had email and phone discussions with park rangers, and here is one of the notes I've received, quote, "I have been a park ranger for 30 years, and I have never seen or heard of such a device. The Park Service can barely afford regular helicopters, much less highly secret craft like this." This was signed by Carol McElhaney, Sacramento County Park Rangers. I also contacted Alexandra Pickovit in public information in the United States Department of Interior, Sequoia National Park Rangers Office in Tulare County. We discussed the images in Earth Files reports, and with her request, I sent her my May 15th, 2007 Earth Files report that included the Chad images for her official comment. And since there are two federal agencies that manage that park, Alexandra also asked me to contact Denise Alonzo in the Tule River District, U.S. Department of Agriculture, United States Forest Service, Giant Sequoia National Monument, and Sequoia National Forest Public Affairs Office. I did. I had the same discussion and also sent to her my Earth Files report for her official comment that has all these Chad images and referenced her to the other reports as well. Within a day, by phone, Denise Alonzo told me that neither she nor anyone in her office had any knowledge or information about the object in the photos. And to date, after repeated phone voicemail and email requests for comment by Alexandra Pickovit, who was extremely nice, I have not yet received a reply from her. But I have received yet another image allegedly photographed last year in May 2006 in Birmingham, Alabama, of a similar dragonfly-type shape object hovering above a power line near a construction site. The eyewitness and photographer says he works for the military and has asked for anonymity to protect his job. He has emailed me quite a bit. We've had private exchanges, and he has sent me also information I'm not sharing tonight, but I think this is a very serious report. After he took the photo, he had work to do in the vicinity, but returned to the intersection to see if the aerial object was still there, and it was not. But parked nearby were two pickup trailer rigs that stood out as very clean and shiny next to this dirty, dusty construction site. And he sent me a second photograph of one of the all-white pickup trailer units with cable stretching from the trailer next to a power pole. And I could not help but think of the shiny
white, all white, unmarked vans that ranchers and law enforcement kept having reports about when the animal mutilations were all over the place in the 70s to the 80s. They talked about clean, unmarked white vans. Now, this image of this particular unmarked vehicle and the image, this new image from Birmingham, they are both at a new report that is up at Earth Files today. And I also embedded in this report, this Earth Files report with this new Birmingham image, or images, a YouTube link that was sent to me. It is a very brief video. This is not animation. This is clearly, it looks like a military base environment. You can see what seems to be an aircraft hangar in the background. And briefly, a small object that looks exactly like the we'll call it the drone in Chad's photos. It rises from the ground while it spins. But the tape doesn't last very long. I think it's fascinating that somehow this ended up in YouTube, and it looks like some kind of an experiment.
It does. You know, you and I have been emailing Whitley Strieber all day today, Linda.
Yeah.
He's about 50-50, but he's tipping toward that whatever it is, it's real. But, you know, he's been in the line, but he's slowly moving the other way now.
Well, he sent me an email and said, I think that you're beginning to nail this in the sense that I'm looking at this with, I don't pretend to have answers, but at my Earth Files report that I put up today about this new witness from Birmingham and the witness from Sequoia, I also show maps where you have the Sequoia Park and you have China Lake Naval Air Station right next to it to the east. And to the west and north, you have Beale Air Force Base. And they are both known for tremendous numbers of black projects. And if you go down from Sequoia, right at the southern end, you get to Portersville, you get to Porterville, to Bakersfield, and into that area where some of these other sightings have been. And if you go almost straight west from the top of the park, you come to Capitola. And when you look at these map pieces and you start thinking that if there is a black drone project out there, I don't know why it would be public in 2005, 2006, 2007. I don't understand that part, but I think that there is something in this drone category, and if some of the still very back channel communication is pointing in any kind of a direction that might be correct, it is that our government has been working with what is called, they may have a different term, but the term being used for me is ion electrostatic propulsion. Well, if that might explain why it has such a weird design, and when it may be also why it gives off that electrostatic sound that Chad described being closer to it. And I would like my, like I've done on so many reports that I have done over the year or two on Coast, if there is anybody who has any information about a black project or any other kind of a project that is using this kind of a dragonfly-like looking object that is some kind of an electrostatic ion propulsion system or other, I would very much like to hear from you. My email address is earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Think of a reporter filing news about the Earth, earthfiles@earthfiles.com. And I am keeping all confidences respected. And I feel that this may be a subject, George, no matter what final answers, if any, ever come, that I'm learning a lot. I hope the audience is learning a lot. I hope you are learning a lot about now a whole new facet of what may be a new energy system in aerial devices, that it may be something like if this Forest Service person
was actually acting double duty.
Mm-hmm.
And he was working for another agency but was dressed up like a forest ranger and knows that they have to deflect public attention and that some people are wired to be able to say, oh, it is just a monitoring device, and most people told something by a person in uniform will kind of accept it. But right now we know we've got a Coast audience, an Earth Files audience, that is wanting some answers that we're not getting on the 6 o'clock news, that there's a lot that is happening out there that we're not being told about. And hopefully this is one of those stories where we can all learn together about perhaps a brand new project that none of us have been told anything about. But here is this woman in Sequoia National Park who she's as honest as the day is long. And she saw this and had a brief conversation with somebody dressed up in a uniform who told her it was a monitoring device looking for problems in fires. And she accepted it until she saw Chad's images and said, oh, that's what I saw in Sequoia 2 years ago.
Stay with us, Linda. We'll be back now. Conversations with Linda Moulton Howe. So we're going to open up the phone lines. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back with Linda Moulton Howe here on Coast to Coast. Let's go right to the phones. Wildcard Line, you're up with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Take it away.
Yeah, Linda.
Yes, sir.
Back in the 80s, I was in Laramie, Wyoming, and I met a gentleman there that had a most fantastic story to tell about how he needed water out on his property. And he met these three people out there that showed him where it was at, and he talked about going to other planets. And I called Leo Springfield,
yeah.
And he knew him, and he said that they'd given him a polygraph test and sodium pentothal and hypnotized him. And he said that he thoroughly believed everything that had happened to him.
This is Leo Springfield, who was director of counseling and testing at the University of Wyoming.
Okay.
And you're talking about a case that was in my film, A Strange Harvest.
Exactly, because I went back to Boulder, and within a few days after that, I heard the television, and I could hear the fear in your voice, and I didn't know what was going on. I was in the kitchen trying to make a sandwich, and I went in the front room to find out what was on the television, and it was you with your...
A Strange Harvest.
Right, and you were talking about the guy that I'd met in Laramie.
Right, and it was in Bosler, Wyoming. And the rancher was McGuire, and Leo Springfield had done a hypnosis session with him actually prior to when I had started the investigation into animal mutilations. But I went up there to the ranch because Leo was so aware of the fact that this man was having cattle mutilations, missing time, light. And when the crew and I, this literally happened, the crew and I pulled up in the Channel 7 KMGH TV station wagon. And we were getting equipment out. We were getting tripods set up. We still didn't have all of our gear. We literally were there like 5 or 10 minutes. And McGuire said, Linda, I want to take you out and show you a place where we can stand. And I see lights moving over that ridge all the time where the animals are mutilated. And at that time, I was still like Alice in Wonderland, still on the other side of the mirror, not knowing what kind of a story I really was in. When people talked about lights and something that was not from this earth, I had not grown up with that context. And it was weird to me that this rancher was saying this right after we arrived. But my cameraman and my audio man, we decided we would walk with him just to see. And all of our equipment is back at the station wagon. And we are walking with him, and he says, look. And right over the ridge, rising slowly, not fast, but tomato red. I mean, tomato cherry red. Not like Mars. This was red, and it gleamed. And we stopped, and he said, that's one of them. That's like one of them that mutilates animals.
And we stood there, and I'm trying to get my astronomy mind thinking about what in the world can this be. And my cameraman starts running back to the station wagon to get a camera. And my audio guy is standing there with his mouth open. Linda, what is this? And I'm saying, I'm not sure. And my audio man said, well, what if it comes, starts coming our way? I said, well, we got to film it. Run back and get your audio gear on. So now the crew is trying to get the gear, and we're watching this thing, and it gets brighter and brighter. And all of a sudden, it moved left, it moved right. It moved left, it moved right, and it went straight down behind that ridge. And I said, there isn't an astronomical body, there isn't a planet or a star that I know that can rise, move left and right, and then go back down. So that was our sort of baptism into high strangeness right off the bat as a crew, and that was on the Bosler Ranch, and later Leo and the hypnosis session that Leo had done with him formed a part of my film, A Strange Harvest.
You know, Linda, while I was talking about Leo Sprinkle for a moment, I was thinking of Leonard Stringfield.
Right, and he was in Cincinnati.
Yes, and he was incredible. I mean, one of the best. And he was one of the first ufologists to take crashed saucer stories seriously.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He broke ground. He pioneered on that in a way sort of like I have pioneered in the whole animal mutilation phenomena research. And, you know, before we get too far off track, I just want to give you some fast highlights on the honeybee disappearance.
Yeah.
Because there's bad news and good news. The bad news, on May 21st, it was the Persian Daily from Iran, and it was actually transferred through Reuters, reported that bees have been dying or disappearing at an alarming rate in the western and northwestern regions of Iran. And that the reason for, and this is the words now quoting from the news story, for the unprecedented loss of bee colonies in Ardabil, east and west, Azerbaijan, as well as Kurdistan provinces is still unknown. Since last week, and we're talking about current, May 21st, so this is the week before this week, since last week, the mass deaths or disappearances of honeybees, as well as the abandoning of hives, have inflicted huge financial damages to beekeepers. This is Iran. Now, sort of paralleling that, in the United States, Wisconsin beekeepers began reporting in the last week or two also huge disappearances characteristic with this colony collapse disorder. But you might say slightly better news. In Florida, they were not sure if they were going to be reporting 60 to 70% losses in that state. And so far from surveys, it's 38% of all of the colonies known in the state of Florida have disappeared between October and now. But it's leveling off at about 38 to 40%. And they're seeing in the rest of the country from surveys that the entire nation of the United States seems to be, I don't know if the word is leveling off, stabilizing, or a momentary pause, at about 25% to 35% losses of all of our nation's honeybees, which leaves us right now. I talked with Jerry Hayes about this. He is the chief of the apiary section for Florida's Department of Agriculture, and he's president of the Aviary Inspectors of America in Gainesville, who have done some of these surveys. And I asked him about whether he thinks that we have enough pollinators for 2007 to 2008, and this was his answer. Linda, we're right at what I think is 50-50. And it could go either way. And we don't know yet. We could end up with not enough pollinators, and then the problem will be again in 2008. We do not have a healthy honeybee nationwide situation, and so do not a lot of other people. But the good news, if it'll hold, is that there aren't massive bee disappearances being reported in the United States. And I asked him about the organic bee question.
And they seem to be doing okay.
Well, he answered very interestingly. He said, we don't have a category for organic bees, and this is the reason that he gave. He said, honeybees forage in such a wide area that organic is a difficult name to live up to for honeybee production. And he said, if bees can forage on a 4 to 5 mile diameter circle, think of 2 to 2.5 miles radius, or about 5 miles if it's a full circle, that is a huge acreage, and those bees, and this is a quote, can get into things that the well-intentioned beekeeper would have no idea what the bees are in and what they bring back. And his point, I think I understand, that it would be very difficult to know and to say that bees were organic. But I understand also, with great respect, the organic beekeepers are trying to reduce hugely the amount of pesticide exposure, artificial food, all of that. And so there is an effort to try to make the healthiest bees. And as we go forward, the whole issue of what is the bottom line? Well, remember back in February and March when I started reporting about this on Coast to Coast, one of the areas that was rising in my mind to the surface immediately were those nicotine-based pesticides. Well, guess what? They have now got hard laboratory data. What are they finding in the wax, in the brood food, in the honey, in a lot of the colony collapse, the hives that they've studied? Higher levels of nicotine-based pesticides. Well, what's the next step? Columbia University is trying to refine the analysis, and he told me something I did not know was such a challenge. When you are at this level in which an entire industry of pesticides may be affected, because if this proves to be what is causing the problems with pollinators, or at least one of the top two or three reasons, it may be that there's going to have to be either a complete ban, like France did, on nicotine-based pesticides in the United States, which would affect a large industry, or they're going to have to modify how it is used. Either way, it means that FDA, USDA, EPA are going to have to get together with a consensus after the scientific data is brought to the table, and it appears that there are problems with this nicotine-based pesticide when it comes to honeybees and perhaps other pollinators. Now, how this is going to unfold, no one knows, because they have to have what is called a chain of evidence, just like in a court of law. And that means that they are now trying to assemble data with what is called, that they've got a paper trail from the person who does the analysis, the original result. Mm-hmm. And he said this is something no one has ever done before in relationship to bees, but that the stakes are so high, the issues are so critical, that this is now what they're trying to do. So I would say that by the fall again in 2007, we might have a clearer, we'll call official answer, and it may be coupled with congressional action to provide money for both more research and trying to shore up the problems that they are now finding in a combination of things of which this nicotine-based pesticide may be a problem. Even though it has helped replace the organic phosphates, and everybody thought that it was going to be safer, the patents have run out on it. It's moving into generic, cheaper levels, and it is being used now all over the world, and it may be that that is a problem for bees and their memories.
Well, let's hope we get some of the answers. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yes, hi, Linda.
Yeah.
Hi, hon. Thank you so much for what you're doing for everybody. You're such a informative person, and you're helping so many people. But there's two things. Something you just mentioned, they said that Monsanto has changed the genetics of the plants, and they said this is also affecting the bees also.
Well, that question comes up constantly. And the problem is that I haven't been able yet so far to find hard data outside of a new report that has just come from a Professor Katz, or Kotz, in Germany, that might have to do, for the very first time, with
changes in the bee gut that relate to genetic modifications in GMO crops.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I'm saying it's preliminary is because Professor Kotz himself, who has reported that he personally thinks that the new research that they've just reported in Europe is the first hard scientific evidence that there's a link between what happens in plant cells, what goes into bees, and what goes into a bee gut. But they want more work on this before they say this, like, really hard data. But now, why would this be so important? Not only might this hurt the honeybees, but now they're concerned that the changes that they're seeing in the honeybee gut might imply, I'm not saying that this is hard data, but it implies that what we eat as humans of genetically modified crops may also be affecting our ability to fend off disease, deal with antibiotics, and a lot of other things, because the chain reaction is, if there are gut changes in the bees, does it mean there might be gut changes in humans exposed? And we're in a huge area now in which there is going to be a lot of controversy. Again, the pharmaceuticals and the GMOs and all, those are huge, gigantic industries, and they have a lot at stake. And as science keeps finding more and more about what happens with GMO crops and the impacts, let's say, on honeybees, and the questions start raising about what's happening to humans, you're probably going to hear, this laboratory says, no, this is the wrong work. And all of us, every one of us, has to reach out and get our news from a variety of sources, I think, to try to stay balanced on what's happening.
Let's go to one or two more callers. First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yes, George. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Good. Thank you.
I'm a firefighter. Work with the U.S. Forest Service down here in Georgia fighting this large wildfire that we have down here. And listening to Linda talk about the hovering object in Sequoia, sounds awfully it raises some question. While I usually keep an open mind, it raises the obvious question of, well, if this was a government thing, why would they test it in a place, in such a public place like Sequoia National Park?
We'd all like to know the answer to that.
It seems like there's obviously other places that they could test it that would be a little bit less public. And I know for a fact they don't use anything like that on fire. So if either, you know, the guy was, like you say, not who he said he was, or it's something else.
Right. My guess is that whoever was in that uniform was doing double duty for something else and knew exactly what that was. And in talking to her, we talked hours, Shirley and I, and I asked her quite a bit about the demeanor of him when she asked, what is that? And she does not think he even looked up in the sky when he answered, right? And that would indicate...
That's weird.
Well, this is would be a person, right, who was briefed to be as nonchalant
mm-hmm.
as possible. And
definitely.
Yeah, I wonder what was inside of that ranger station that might have been communicating with or monitoring what that thing was flying over. We'll never know, but Shirley is telling what she saw.
Definitely. Well, keep up the good work.
Thank you.
All right, next up, let's go west of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Go ahead, real quickly.
Hello, this is David. Here in Cedar, Utah, I can tell you quite a bit, Linda, about the drive, the motor that drives these machines. I was a contractor in Area 51 for a number of days, and they told me I could get there quicker if I took another little road, and I took it, and the guardhouse stopped me, and then an airplane, a fighter airplane, came to check me out. I looked out my window. I was going about 55 miles an hour, and the plane was maybe 30 feet away from me, wing going exactly my speed, no sound. The wing was tipped down maybe 30 degrees toward the ground, and the pilot was just staring at me. And he was there all some time. And then he pulled his wings back up to the level, and then took off at an awesome speed.
Jeez, my God.
They're capable of.
Well,
now, I have also seen other planes parked in the sky, just waiting to for their turn to come down and land at the airport runway.
I sure would like to communicate with you. Can you send me an email to earthfiles@earthfiles.com so we can talk?
I gave my computer away.
Oh, well,
I'm a grandpa, so I don't have one. But if you give me your mailing address or your telephone, I could.
All right, I'll tell you what. We're going to put you on hold and get some information. Gina, get his information, and we'll get it to you, Linda.
Okay, thank you very, very much.
Absolutely. Thanks, Linda. I'll talk to you next time.
Yeah, George.
I'll be back in a moment. Open lines on Coast to Coast AM.